It is just over 500 years since Thomas More coined the word utopia, which is Greek for no place. Utopia is where everything is perfect. As Ed Abbey pointed out, the only problem with perfection is there's no room for improvement. During the 1960s and 1970s, New Mexico became a nexus for communes, experiments in establishing communities, each based on principles either predetermined or evolving at the bidding of the respective communards. Many of these communes were located in or around Taos County, and while some of the longtime residents found hippie perspectives and practices distasteful and unsuitable, others were welcoming. The Peyoteros of the Taos Pueblo were particularly welcoming and recognized a sense of spiritual kindredness in many of the communards. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. Reno Meyerson has rooted himself in northern New Mexico for half a century and has often served as a goodwill ambassador in behalf of newly arriving counterculturalists.
We introduced the Hog Farm to New Mexico. My partner Tom Law and I myself knew Wavy Gravy, who was the founder of the Hog Farm, and his wife had for some years. Tom's older brother John, who was a film star, and John Law was part of the cast of a movie made by Otto Preminger, his last film, called Skidoo, with the wildest cast of characters you've ever seen. Through making that film, which involved part of the cast being a lot of hippies to be part of the background of the story, Tom and myself arranged for about 150 hippies to be part of this film in the background. The Hog Farm, which was a separate entity from our musical commune and so forth, they made enough money to purchase their buses to start their adventure as the Hog Farm as we know it today. They went to New Mexico, bought land, had a commune, participated in the counterculture here. Some of those folks remained here and some returned to California, where they set up another entity there, where they have a beautiful piece of land in Northern California where they have a summer camp for children and adults as well, which is totally counterculture. It's the circus arts and it's training in all kinds of wonderful medium to grow up in. So, yes, we were involved with the Hog Farm in that capacity. We helped them. They got here. They are totally city dwellers, didn't know how to poop in the woods. So we sort of took them through the basics of learning how to live at the land. They're all very trained and wise fools, but didn't know some of the ways here in New Mexico. Also to develop an appreciation for the multiple cultures here as well. So many hippies that had come here to local Hispanic and Native American peoples, many of them felt it was like an invasion of some foreign entity. The media had already established hippieism as quite a negative thing in our culture. And when I moved here, when I first bought land here in the rural mountain area, there was a tremendous amount of negativity towards us, you know, and only because I was a landholder that I purchased land was I sort of accepted. When the hippies really arrived a couple of years later, you know, in throngs, and they were camping everywhere and carrying on in one way or another, not very consciously, they would come to us and say, "What's going on with these people?" It sort of became our responsibility to take them on and hip them to what the local reality was, and at the same time cool out the local folks so that they understood that, you know, these are not bad people and nobody's going to take anything from you and they're not thieves and they're not whatever they may have conjured in their mind. And there were, in the school programs, and there were anti-hippie drawing, you know, draw hippies for the kids in school, you know, or they were, you know, make up stories and tell them about these people until we gradually got to know them and they knew us and they started to think differently. And the whole culture in those villages today is quite different. It's still the same poor folks as ever. However, they are much more wise to it all.
One day not long ago, my phone rang and the voice at the other end of the line said, "Make sure you have a Q-tip handy to clean your ear, because this is Wavy Gravy coming at you." Hugh Romney, a.k.a. Wavy Gravy, referred to himself as a teenage beatnik in the 1950s when he read poetry in Greenwich Village, a bohemian neighborhood in Lower Manhattan. Wavy has been on a busman's holiday for over 50 years.
Christmas Day, the mechanics in our expanded family purchased a bus, which we immediately started to decorate. And we had no idea where it was going to go, but along came Otto Preminger, who was making a film called Skidoo. Groucho Marx played God, and we were extras. I ended up in El Valle or somewhere in New Mexico with our bus and Ken Babb's bus, and we had all this money from Otto Preminger from Skidoo that put all these buses on the road. And we began to multiply and go from campground to campground in New Mexico, and ended up in Llano, where we purchased 12 acres. Llano, yeah. And yeah, we did this event where we take a caravan of buses to Los Alamos and do a love-in in Los Alamos. Very lurid title, probably 68. And that's what I figure, because 69 was Woodstock. So I ended up doing the life support announcements at Woodstock, which catapulted me through the movie to international prominence, especially with the line, "Good morning. What we have in mind is breakfast in bed for 400,000, which is when we introduced hippies to granola. They were all laying in mud in the front of the stage, and we brought it to them in Dixie cups. They'd look at it and say, "What is this, gravel?" But they ate it and they liked it. And I think the granola manufacturers of the world owe us an enormous debt. Janis Joplin had a beautiful line. She said, "If you have any food left, share it with your brother and your sister, and that's the person on your right and the person on your left." I think people got a pretty deep print about what sharing was about. It was an illumination and a magical event that the spirits of the planet decided to interject their magic into a rock and roll show to make it a great teaching. And I still feel some of it today, and so do a lot of people.
Lisa Law has long distinguished herself as a major documentarian of the counterculture in the West. Her photographs provide great insight into hippie consciousness and celebrity, as well as life in the communes.
The difference in communes, they all have their basis. Rick Klein, who'd given his inheritance to build New Buffalo, he wasn't like a leader. It was everybody working together and having discussions and little meetings and discussing what they were going to do, that group. So that group was more amicable to what I was feeling. And then the hog farm was the tightest, because these people stayed together and did all sorts of things for other downtrodden people. Like, they'd started SAVO, which is Saves the Eyesight and the Nepalese People. They were dealing with Larry Brilliant, who ended smallpox. That group is, to me, the epitome of the greatest commune there is, because they're still together today. They're still doing things today, and they have Camp Winter Rainbow, and they still have SEVA, and it's a group that's never going to be broken up. They're all part of that same group today. It's a mindset, and it helping society and helping to save the planet. So they're all still together, as far as I know, the ones that are alive.
Tom Law had long been a practitioner of yoga. He'd met Yogi Bhajan on the West Coast and invited the yogi to visit New Mexico. Yogi Bhajan was a Sikh and a master of Kundalini yoga. After his arrival in New Mexico, he gradually gained a following and ultimately established his ashram on land located near Española, New Mexico. Yogi Bhajan passed from this world in October 2004, But the ashram remains a vital spiritual center. Here, Guru Fatah Kaur Khalsa characterizes the spiritual practices that remain to this day.
We try to be inclusive of what people would be interested in, what is valuable to someone's experience in life. So the large scope of the spiritual practice has to do with the Sikh way of life, which Yogi Bhajan was born into. He was born a Sikh in what's now Pakistan, 1929, and he came from a very established Sikh family. However, he then, with those values, he also was very interested in other spiritual leaders or yogis or swamis, and got interested in yoga. He became master of Kundalini Yoga when he was 16. When he came to the West, he was interested in teaching people about the science of yoga in terms of health and well-being. He stayed in Los Angeles for quite a long time teaching yoga, and what he found was a lot of people really searching, not so much for physical wellness, but mental wellness, spiritual well-being, a sense of purpose. And he started just teaching people what he knew. And we were like sponges.
Kiri Altmas Singh is part of the ashram in Española. He speaks of the idealism that resides in the hearts and minds of his fellow practitioners.
We're idealistic people, and we got into this, I think, by and large, for idealistic reasons, of something that gave us, each of us, an experience of something within us that was greater than ourselves. It appealed to me about the Sikh way of life and that there wasn't proselytizing. You remember in the 60s, all the street preachers and the hippie preachers or whatever, and there was just all kinds of stuff happening. To me, it's like, there's a scene in the Monty Python movie, The Life of Brian, of like the marketplace, and there's one section in the marketplace where the different spiritual teachers are making their pitch. And, you know, that's how things were at that time. And Yogi Bhajan never said, okay, here's the plan to go get more people wearing turbans. It's like, here's this message, you know, try it if you like it. If it works for you, then do it. If it doesn't work for you, don't.
We try to encourage people to rise early in the morning and meditate, practice some yoga, then gather together in the company of like-minded people. We call it the satsangat. It's the company of the holy. That's another way you could put it. So you can start your day on the right foot and feel your soul and your body nurtured so that when you step into the world for your day, whatever that may bring, you have a base of something to come back to, some kind of reality, especially if something difficult happens or if you're in a stressful time. You can always have a little bit of better understanding and ability to cope with the things life brings. So here in New Mexico, we have a really beautiful gurdwara, which is a Sikh place of worship. Gurdwara means guru's door. So you're entering through the door of getting your knowledge, of finding your base with your inner knowledge. That's kind of like the spiritual aspect of looking at going in the door. Our practice starts at about 3:45, and we do a prayer which is called Japji, which was written by the first guru, Guru Nanak of the Sikhs, and it really explains the universe. And of course, as you read it throughout your life, I keep finding new things that I hadn't really thought of before or realized. It's a journey every day. Then we practice Kundalini Yoga for about 40 minutes, and then we do about an hour of chanting together. And this practice can be done by yourself at any place with a group, but we try to encourage people to come together so there's a support system. And then we finish with a small gurdwara service in our building here, which involves singing a kirtan together and praying together for the well-being of the community and of the planet, and also infusing that prayer with how walking into the day of wondering how we can serve the planet, how we can serve anybody we meet with a smile, with some food, with some love, just going into your day with hopefully that you can carry that on throughout your whole day. And then we finish with a reading from our Guru Granth Sahib, which is like an inspiration for the day. And we finish off just greeting each other with the day and going off to our various families and professions and things that we do during the day. So that's kind of the basic morning practice.
This was Yogi Bhajan's kind of his motto. There's in the morning prayer Japji, there's a couplet that goes, Ketya duk buk sadmar ebidat teridatar, which Guru Nanak is saying to God, even if you give me hunger, pain, and death, even these I'm going to look at as your gift. So thank you.
The Sikh way of life is to live as a householder, which means you don't really go off into the woods or the jungle, as it would be said in Indian terms, to spend years discovering whatever it is. You have to live in the world, earn honestly, share with others, and be in your family, but still recognize the balance of your temporal life and your spiritual life. And so they're always in balance, giving each other fuel for proceeding on with your day and your life. And hopefully bringing up your family with those same values as best you can, so you can pass on really the essence of yourself, your own truth, your own love.
I first met Steve and Barbara Durkee and their daughter Kobe when they came to visit my fire lookout in northwestern New Mexico on July 3, 1965. They were friends with my old friend Stuart Brand. We spent a few delightful days together, and they decided that New Mexico was to become their home. 2 years later, they founded Lama, a community devoted to spiritual practices which remains to this day. Barbara Durkee has since changed her name to Asha Greer. Here she tells of meeting Little Joe Gomez, a peyote roadman from the Taos Pueblo, whose influence extended to many communes in New Mexico.
Now, we met Little Joe at a peyote meeting down at Chris and Cynthia's, but that was interesting too, because we drove him up to the Pueblo, and as we were driving up the river, he started talking about fishing and how to hide from the fish. And for me, that was a revelation, just to have somebody telling me how to hide from a fish so I could catch one, because I had never caught fish, you know, except in those little toy places that you pay and there's water and fish and hooks. And we had set up also to be a place where people could come and be in nature. And I'm just telling you things that influenced me to the place where I'm finally wanting a few bugs on my plants, seeing the holes on my plants. I mean, I've come to that very recently, but now when I take a walk and I see a hole on a plant, I don't see it as an injury to the plant. I see it as an ecological good thing. Feed the birds. It seemed to me, and I don't know whether I was making it up or not, that if someone went from Lama to every corn dance, then the rain would come across that plain and land right on our garden. I'm not very woo-woo, you know, but I mean, after you observe something enough time. Now, it might be I had some kind of suction system that could bring it, but it takes a certain kind of belief to even have an activity like that.
Hans von Briesen, who was also known as Siddiq, is Asha Greer's brother and has been associated with Lama for over 4 decades. He recalls meeting Herman Rednick, an artist who was long known in Taos County as Herman the Hermit.
Herman Rednick was an artist, and he had moved to San Cristobal by the time we met him. He was a meditation teacher. He had a group of students. He painted these rather large, very far out mystical paintings, visionary paintings that had something to do with the spiritual path. And I suppose they might have been phenomena that he had experienced in his work, in his meditations. I don't really know. They were quite lovely, but they were very visionary. They were not, quote, realistic, end quote. He seemed to be a very practical person. I think it was the second visit, or when we came to stay, that we might have met him. And we actually started taking his meditation class Sunday mornings. And he gave us these homework where we would do a particular concentration and try to maybe write about it and then talk about it at the next meeting. And that was coupled with meditation. Anyway, he was the one who said that practicality at all levels is the essence of spirituality. Asha said that other people said that too. She claims that Murshid Sam said that, but I think it was Herman that said that in those terms. Eventually, he kind of disapproved. Steve would have different ladies would be attracted to Steve, and Herman disapproved of any kind of promiscuity, although I heard later that he had broken up a marriage by having an affair with one of his students, which surprised me. So there were a lot of things about Lama that he did not approve of, even though his advice was central to Lama's survival and longevity. I think he looked at Be Here Now and decided it was, I don't know what he decided it was. I think he might have even been extreme enough to say it was the work of the devil. You know, he had his own way of looking at things, and I think that the whole hippie phenomenon, I think he really disapproved of. And we were marginally hippies. I don't think we were, but, you know, we were sort of very close to being hippies.
When the permaculture movement came, we were all about spiritual. We were all about realization and waking up and all of that. And then the permaculture religion came up to Lama, and so taking care of the land became what the work was. And the spiritual stuff was seen as kind of ancillary to it. I mean, I don't know exactly how a place like Lama, for instance, can continue, given the kind of soil that's there. I don't think people can feed themselves, but there is a place down the hill that does have a community garden. And I think the community gardens are really the answer for how to work, particularly for this generation and the next generation who are not used to working hard. That having grown up in Los Angeles, number one, I didn't know anything much about seasons. And I certainly didn't know about phases of the moon or the sun and its movement and the shortened days. I mean, I knew it about it from school, but it's so tragic that everybody cannot follow just four seasons of 3 months each. If not for any other reason, to understand the world's poetry, what it feels like in the spring if you've been through a winter. Having picked your own food and harvested and eating your own food off of plants, that was a very large thing that happened for us. And I guess I'd have to say that the counterculture movement, because we got involved with acid quite early in the psychedelic movement, that opening up to the natural world in the way that one is one with it, that those aren't nouns out there, all those plants. Those aren't trees out there. There's this whole energy field that's so awake that I think that that kind of worked at all of our underbellies, you know, to bring us alive to the possibilities, you know, in the Peyote Church too, that we had been also kind of programmed to be rationalists, you know, and scientists, and believe in progress as though progress was making more gadgets, more machines, more people. And of course the Malthusian question about overpopulation, here we are. What are we now, 7.5 billion?
In 1963, Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert were fired from Harvard for administering psychedelic substances to members of the student body. Richard Alpert had long been a friend to the Durkees. After a long and illuminating adventure in India, Richard changed his name to Ram Dass and continued his association with the Durkees.
So when we lived with Ram Dass for a year, and we had three models, psychedelic lightships, dome communities, and spiritual dude ranches, you know, places where people could come and have not just LSD or something like that, but where there was a whole, like Esalen, I suppose you could call it, although that's not quite so spiritual. We did down by the riverside this psychedelic light show that was very successful in New York. It was in Life magazine, had a lot of pictures from it, and when Life magazine was a big deal. But then we came back. Well, anyway, he went to India. He went to India and he came back, and he came back and he asked Steve if he wanted to make a book. And so then he came to Lama and he wanted to write what had happened to him in India. So four of us were in the library stamping rubber stamps and doing drawings. That's how it happened. He would write, Steve would divide the pages up, and then he made that cover. Still, I mean, when I tell people I had anything to do with that book, their jaws drop, younger people.
Well, at some point, Ram Dass needed more money for his teaching. And I don't know exactly what the arguments were, but Steve and Ram Dass agreed that it would be a great idea to make this into a trade paperback book. And I think Ram Dass knew Bruce Harris at Crown Harmony Books, and the whole thing could be reduced to proper size. And then the printers were already, you know, in place. They had already done a lot of printing for us. No, I think Ram Dass is a brilliant man and extraordinarily articulate and charismatic in a very different way than, say, Steve was charismatic. I heard that in his classes at Harvard, he just drew people like flies because he was such a great speaker. So he had that talent all along, and it's been really well used in service to Maharaji's teaching. I feel deeply grateful for his work. And I'm sort of glad I didn't meet him before he became Ram Dass, because I might have been really turned off. During our first visit to Lhama, Steve was talking about Ram Dass and about Tim, and he thought, because Steve was already on a spiritual journey, and he understood that that was part of what he was doing. It wasn't just a community. There was more to it, much more to it. And I remember him saying that he thought, at least at that time, that Tim just hadn't gotten it, that he had taken all this LSD and he hadn't gotten it. And I think it had something to do with the spiritual journey, that it was more still a psychological journey, not a spiritual journey. And clearly Ram Dass began to understand that it was a spiritual journey as well.
The Lhama community still exists, although its founders now live in different habitats in the United States. Ram Dass lives quietly in Hawaii. Be Here Now is part of the Hanuman Foundation in Taos, New Mexico. We've listened to the voices of Reno Meyerson, Wavy Gravy, Lisa Law, Guru Fatah Kaur Khalsa, Siri Atma Singh Khalsa, Asha Greer, and Sadiq Von Briesen. Voices of Counterculture is funded by grants from the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. Our radio series coincides with Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest, a major exhibition on display at the New Mexico History Museum at the Palace of the Governors in Santa Fe, extending from May 14th 2017 through February the 11th, 2018. The exhibition is accompanied by a book of the same title, Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. Our theme music is performed by Carl Bernstein. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.